Hello and welcome to Too Rash, Too Unadvised, ostensibly stymied by Seven Surrenders. My name is Liam Nolan.
And my name is Wero Kariuki.
And today we are discussing chapters 5 and 6. If you want to ask us any questions or be on the show, please feel free to reach out to us at toorashtounadvised@gmail.com. That's 2 as in the number 2, and I may check that email, so no spoilers, please. Also support us, and more importantly, our editor, on Patreon. With that out of the way, and many thanks to our Lord and Savior, Wes.
An eternal tyrant, well, of course, Kel.
Let's get on with the show. Okay, so okay. Chapter 5 happened, right? Chapter 5 existed. Bridger's going to save Mycroft. He gets a bunch of fun Mycroft-saving stuff. But, frankly, after Chapter 6, I barely care about it at all. So let's power through 5 real quick, if you have anything you want to talk about in it.
It's interesting that seeing the list of all the different things Bridger has was fun.
It was. It raises some questions about what sorts of things... It raises some questions about what sorts of things Bridger can animate. Mm-hmm. Because one would think that Bridger should be able to animate much better equipment than this if the answer was anything. So
really? Better in what? He has two magic wands.
Well, kind of exactly, right? Why animate two magic wands when you could animate a pill that makes you succeed at saving Mycroft, with no consequences?
What would that mean?
It would mean that you animate a pill, you take the pill, and then, like Harry Potter style, no matter what, the next thing you do is successfully save Mycroft, and the plan goes off without a hitch. We're going to call it the pill of poor pacing, and Bridger could have made that. And then we would listen to the plan, and then the next chapter would just say, and then they did the plan. And you're not relying on Excalibur, right? You're relying on the magic pill of everything already worked out. So I think there must be some limitations.
It doesn't let you, like, respond to any information. Like, what if it turns out that it's better to not save Mycroft for whatever reason? You can't do anything because, like, your plan succeeds and you have to save Mycroft.
Walk through me this, or walk. So then I just need to come up with a better. Like, they sat here long enough to come up with a teleporter, a magic mirror, resurrection potion. Like, they got a big list of stuff. You don't think they could have made up a list of contingencies to write into the pill formula to make? They clearly have a plan.
I don't.
Fine.
I don't think
I'm being
can.
Too
I think
specific.
It's much
make
more
it a pill
risky.
Of whatever you want. Right. Like, there's no animate a. A new being whose only purpose is successfully enacting Bridger's will.
That Done. Seems mean.
It seems effective.
You've made something, and what is its purpose? To be a slave.
We can let it be happy. That's fine. It really likes it. What's the problem?
There's a lot of problems with that.
Well, I am in perhaps a... annoyed mood. I read chapter 6 for context for the listeners 5 minutes before we started recording. I found out we were doing chapter 6 an hour before we started recording. Those of you who have read ahead and have listened to this show are not going to be surprised that it's left me in a bit of a mood when it comes to this book. But yeah, I think it's possible that Bridger can only animate things that perhaps other people know about. So maybe maybe Redder wasn't actually Bridger's imaginary friend. Maybe Bridger's power draws from some sort of collective consciousness. And I have
the
a theory.
World's imaginary friend that's not, that Dominic killed and gutted.
Or he was from a specific book. Maybe Redder came from a particular, like, children's TV show. I don't know. There are a lot of versions of that story I could tell, but I think Bridger cannot animate anything. Perhaps he can only animate things that there is sort of a broad understanding of culturally.
Well, the power is given to us as Pritchard can animate toys. Right, that's what Mycroft tells Carlyle.
But Mycroft's kind of lying, because he can also animate... Like, toy is so broad that it includes a picture of a potion on a piece of paper. And if that counts, a success pill should also count.
I don't think that follows at all. A picture of a potion on a piece of paper is much more plausibly a toy than a success pill with a dozen contingency plans.
Hang on. I disagree. The pill is for the soldiers. He wants to give one of the soldiers a success pill as a plot point in their soldiering games. That's a toy. It's been made a toy.
It's a bad toy.
They don't have any good toys.
Very X-ray obviously
specs
a bad
are
toy.
A bad toy.
Like it's like those. It's like the when you imagine a kid on the playground saying, "Actually, I have powers. Let me do anything I want." It's like obviously this person is messing up the game. And obviously, the success pill is a bad toy.
I'm not saying it's a good toy. I'm saying it is a toy. And it's what Bridger and the Major should have come up with.
It's such a poor toy that it almost... That I think it exceeds... It's outside the boundaries of what we typically call a toy.
Well, so do... Scissors and tape.
No, what?
Scissors and tape are not toys. They're just stationary items. I disagree.
People use them as toys all the time. Constantly.
Look, just because you're playing
and
having
the
fun
children to play
in an office setting.
In school.
I worked at a school. I did not give children scissors to play with. That's
okay,
how you get fired.
Your school is, like, weird about this. But regular schools do.
Scissors are dangerous. A determined child could cause... dozens of cents worth of injury to themselves.
That's why you give them those shitty scissors. Those bad scissors.
Oh, you think they're toy scissors. That's what the communication is here.
Scissors you give the children. You know, it's like whenever you're a
Bridger
kid, you get access to the good scissors. That was exciting.
I do like a good pair of scissors. But I'm an easy sell on stationery in general. I am... comfortably at my happiest playing with like a laminator.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love a good laminator. Anyway, speaking of the book, we get a little bit of inter-soldier relations early on. Bridger can teleport, by the way. That's a thing they've sorted out and just kind of dropped on us. Croucher is, in fact, a bit of a grump. I get why he was singled out.
But you think he was singled out for, like, somehow being not Major's man.
I think he is not. Actually, that's not true. I think he perhaps is at this point, but I think by the end of the book he won't be. Oh, okay. And also, I need to talk about Jehovah and where I land on what I think is up with him.
Mm-hmm.
So... we had a brief conversation about the whole universe in his brain thing last time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I want to walk some of that back. So here's what I think is happening. And here's what I'm concerned is actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's definitely clear that Jehovah has a universe in his head that he plays with. That literally having a universe in your head would be... It's the literally part where I think we were having two different conversations last time. If I am... I think that the thing that's going to happen is that he will actually have, like, had a universe that is real in the sense that the other extant universes in the story are real inside of his head. And that's not really something I had been on board for as much as he had a imagined universe that he kept very good track of and, like, mentally simulated with fidelity. That someone would sort of play God in their brain as a thought exercise, not really the same thing as them being full up and down, actually a deistic figure. In the sense of having a materially real universe living inside of you. My obvious now prediction is that there might be an actual materially real universe that Jehovah is God of.
Mm-hmm.
But the framing that I was approaching this from for most of that earlier conversation, what I was saying things like, what are you talking about? It's been very clear in this book that he has a universe in his brain, was a lot closer to like a imagined world than a universe. And on reflection, after recording that episode, I made a note in our Discord conversation that I should come back to it. Because I put together how perhaps we had not really been having the same conversation there.
Mm-hmm. And
obviously I'm moving more towards full-blown actual universe. Although I don't love it. I'm annoyed by the idea that it will be true. But we'll move on now so that you can stop sitting there and just saying that you have heard the thing I was saying without risking any words. Do you have anything else in Chapter 5 that you want to point out?
Not really.
Okay. Well then, let's get to Chapter 6,
mm-hmm.
The Room Where Mycroft Canner Died.
Because,
mm-hmm. Oh boy, do I have stuff to say about this.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I opened this chapter, and we started reading it, and I was so on board for what was going on. Mm-hmm. I was actually smiling as I read the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Mycroft was just a bastard.
Uh-huh.
He killed for the sake of killing, because he thought it was cool to do evil for evil's sake,
mm-hmm.
and my objection last week about how that's, I don't really think that hangs together because he clearly sort of also has a motive.
Mm-hmm.
Jehovah shows up and complains about that to him before I even had a chance to do it on the show. Thanks for stealing my thunder there, Jehovah. But
Mycroft also complains directly afterward. He laments the fact that he is in fact not free.
But hooray, I thought. They've done it. Mycroft didn't have a secret motive. He wasn't sad that his family died. The Martys weren't secretly evil and he was doing the right thing. And then three pages later, what do we find out? But that the Martys were secretly warmongers the whole time and that he was saving the peace of the world.
Wait,
am irate.
Wait, what did you think Jehovah was complaining about?
I thought Jehovah was complaining about his internal inconsistency there. He wasn't doing evil for the sake of evil. He was doing evil for the sake of proving a point, which is very different. Ultimately, he was not motivated by the desire to do evil. He was motivated by the desire to show everyone that he was right and they were wrong. And I don't consider that to be evil in any interesting sense.
How do you interpret Mycroft's long bemoanment afterward?
Which one? Give me a page number. Here we go. Still the child lingered. You disappoint me, my Master Canner. I thought to see a liberated man, but still you hide behind a cause. The cause, I presumed at this point, was proving his point, which I was super on board for. The child saw in an instant the hypocrisy I had not quite admitted even to myself. He was right. I was never strong enough to do evil for the sake of evil. Saladin was the true free beast. Still very on board. He was just doing it to prove a point. He was not doing this for the sake of evil. I had merely followed, leaning half on him, half on the crutch of a hidden good that lay beyond the Marty's deaths. The good that I thought he was talking about here was that he would get to prove that he was right and they were wrong. And I was pretty happy with that reading, frankly. So, it wasn't until later.
Like a plain reading. Like, initially, maybe, but then he says, like, plainly, I was doing it for some good. Some hidden good that lay behind the Marty's death.
I guess here's the problem. I already kind of thought his reasoning was bad for the exact reason I laid out there, which is that he was kind of trying to prove a point about stuff. And he kind of thought that stuff would be better if he had proven his point. So I went, yeah, you're right, Mycroft. You did not think this through. Your logic here doesn't hang together as well as the genius you're presenting yourself as suggests that it should. And I was so pleased that we had been told, here's just good old evil Mycroft doing bad stuff, and his argument is bad, and now he will suffer for it. And I have rarely been so on board for anything a piece of fiction has done than when I finally got to this chapter, and I thought I had discovered that the thing I've been worried about this whole time, not a concern. And then no, it was. I should have been more worried.
Well, I think we should go back and reevaluate what Jed and Mycroft said in light of this. So Jed is also disappointed in Mycroft.
Mm-hmm.
For the exact same reason you are.
Yep.
Mycroft is disappointed in Mycroft for the exact same reason you are.
It's true.
I think what's happening here is broader than Mycroft's had to do some, actually this was doing it for utilitarian reasons, or whatever. Or even to push beyond some secret good. Because even as the text tells us that's true, all of these other people who you think who are of varying moral standards are all disappointed in Mycroft.
Yeah, everyone should be disappointed in Mycroft. Mycroft has let all of the readers down. Or at least all the ones I care very much about. Okay, let me read through the rest of this. Now he's worried about... He's lost his conviction because he realized that he was wrong about everything. Frankly, he was probably right to be a little less sure of himself after that. How... Here's my objection.
Mm-hmm.
I want to paint Jed as perhaps a religious figure in the sense that I think they can tell us interesting things about the nature of religion, mm-hmm. but not necessarily sort of a deistic figure in that mm-hmm. I think that they have actual magical powers.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not that it ends up being true, for the sake of this next 5 minutes, let's presume that it is.
Okay.
That Jed could come into a room. Listen to the conversation that's been had. Notice that what Mycroft's saying doesn't really hang together because he's not doing this for the sake of evil for evil's sake, right? He's doing this to prove a point, and it's his point, and he wants everyone to realize that he's right. That person could come in and say, what's his exact line here? You disappoint me, Master Canner. I thought to see the liberated man, but you still hid behind a cause. That makes sense. That 100% tracks for me. That he could show up, hear this conversation, and immediately go, oh, this is because the Martis were trying to start wars. That I'm less on board for. Perhaps he already knew that somehow when no one else did, but it's less satisfying.
I don't think it's true that Jed at this moment knew that exactly what the
you think
had
this
done.
Was his religious sight ability that led him look into what Mycroft's truest beliefs were, and he noticed that they didn't line up with what he was saying.
No, I think it is. I think the first reading is true. It's just what is being noticed is not Mycroft wanted to prove a point, not just to murder people, but that Mycroft didn't want to. Do as he said, to make to kill people and to make the whole world murderers, Mycroft wants to do something good. And Mycroft is not so dedicated to his philosophy as Mycroft thought.
I mean, I think he also... Maybe this is my own bias seeping through here, but I think the Martis dying being so great an outcome wasn't the... I think he also really did want to prove his point about how he was right and everyone else was wrong.
I think that's true. I don't think that's true. I think he wanted to do it. He states a couple of things he wants to do, right, in his speech. He wanted to kill the best people there were, to show people that you could do, to do several things, to show people you can choose to do bad. And then he also wanted to make everyone else participate in that by killing him.
Mm-hmm.
He says he wants to make sure that the leaders carried out the general will to murder him.
Hints of that before.
Huh?
And we've had hints of that before, certainly. Mm-hmm. He specifically spoke about how pleased he would have been to see people calling for his death,
mm-hmm.
even though they would have otherwise said they don't believe in murder, right?
Yeah.
So that tracks.
I think it's like Markov's theater philosophy. And I don't know. I think it, on a first glance, it's fine. In terms of, like, consistency.
See, I think on a first glance, it kind of falls apart.
Okay.
If you have any motive other than evil, you're not proving you can do evil for the sake of evil, and he had a motive other than evil.
His motive like was
he doesn't want to admit he had
to also do evil.
Yeah, well, kind of, but also to prove he was right and they were wrong.
Demonstrations aren't necessarily
good. Like the reason it matters that the other that everyone else chooses evil in the first level reading before we find out about the war stuff, is that he's demonstrating to the world that they're not as good as they thought they were. So,
No, I don't think that's true. I don't think he's trying to show the world. I think he wants the world to feel free.
That was not my read.
And by showing them that he can do this, and that they can do it too, he's making them realize their freedom.
Hmm. In any case, we're needing to do a lot of after-the-fact philosophizing to make his thing work. And even
I don't
with
think...
that...
Yeah, you're right. It is like, by hanging together, I just mean, like, you can preserve the core of it without, like, negating any major premises.
If he had been practicing these speeches for months, as it suggested he did, he should have done a better job then. If we're needing to do this much, and still not agreeing with him, frankly, even if I gave you that and said that is exactly what Mycroft thought, I would still expect Jed or Jehovah, whose name I still have not decided which I should use on this show, to come in and say, you've done a bad job making a philosophy, idiot.
What he's saying here is more rhetorical than philosophizing. The point of his speech isn't just to communicate some of what he believes, it's to make them kill him.
But his speech, he doesn't actually say that many things to them. I'm assuming that most of his speech in this text is to the reader.
No, like, he does... There is a part where Mycroft,
it is.
At the time, speaks. Like, when...
Yeah, but he doesn't say much. He says, like, four sentences. He says... All right, I'm three pages in. He hasn't said a word yet.
He doesn't say a lot. I refuse, in response to to Cornell trying to get Mycroft to agree to replace the Martis. The Emperor says you have no choice, and then Mycroft says, you're the ones with no choice. The world won't rest until it sees me dead. That's how it ends. They'll keep chanting my name until I've had my day in court, and there, the world will see that it's possible to choose evil over good, over happiness, over family, over love, over the future potential of the human race, over life itself. When the axe falls, or the electricity turns on, or whatever you decide to use on me, the world will taste again the base satisfaction of getting its hands dirty, as the human animal was meant to do. You can't avoid it. The world will let you, and neither will I.
Yeah, that's like a paragraph.
Yeah. Look, it's
that's
it's
not
a
big long speech.
It's not a big long
most
speech.
Most of his... Yeah, this is primarily given in text.
Mm-hmm.
And neither of them does a great job.
Well, again, I think the point of this is, like, the point of the words Mycroft says is to... The word Mycroft said at the time was to get himself killed.
I don't think that's true. I don't think he was that worried. He still thought that it was inevitable that they would kill him.
Not at that point.
I think at this point. He doesn't start to go into his whole thing about how he's really worried.
The anonymous, he doesn't sound worried, but the anonymous has said we shouldn't kill him. Mason has said we shouldn't kill him. He's having to argue with the Emperor of the Masons that he in fact should die.
He hasn't yet spoken to Jed, so he hasn't yet had his change of heart. Mm-hmm. He still thinks they're going to kill him at the end.
He thinks they're going to kill him, but I don't think he thinks it's going to be inevitable.
Are you sure?
Yeah. There's some chance that they won't kill him, so he has to like make sure they kill him. He does this by rejecting everything they give him, by declaring that he killed the Martis because he chose to, etc., etc., etc.
Yeah, I'm not convinced.
Okay,
I don't think that's sufficient to really sway me on this one. It turns out, it has turned out to my intense disappointment. That Mycroft probably killed the Martis because the Martis were going to destroy the world.
Okay. So we're going to have to talk about why he killed the Martis in a little bit. But before we move on to that point, we should talk about when Kal-El was captured by that mob of humanists, the humanists, what's it say they said? They said that the cousins prevented Mycroft's death. And I think, I don't remember if Kal-El disagreed or agreed.
I think he disagreed because he thought, no, I guess he knew by then. He probably would have believed that if told it.
Mm-hmm. And he just, I think he just straight up claimed that he was Mycroft Hanna's sensei, which just made them angrier.
The humanists would have assumed it was the cousins who prevented Mycroft's death. Even the Kosala assumed it would be her who prevented Mycroft's death in the story to the public. So, yeah, that seems entirely congruent. People only just found out Mycroft wasn't killed. There wasn't an official announcement from the Hive leaders about it.
Mm-hmm. Once again, I'm just finding the actual line. Yeah, Kal-El says, I've talked to the Chair Kosala personally, and Kosala had nothing to do with the decision not to kill them. Which is false on multiple levels. Kosala did have something to do with the decision not to kill them. Kal-El disagreed, but she was there. Also, Kal-El doesn't know that. I'm pretty sure Kal-El at this point hasn't actually talked to Kosala about this.
That was what... Yeah, Kal-El was just lying, so I'm not sure why you're bringing it back up.
Because Kosala ends up being the only person in the room who wants to kill Mycroft.
Okay. But Kosala didn't say anything. Another character lied about having a conversation with Kosala about this. That doesn't...
Okay, the entire conversation tells us that first, everyone else assumes the cousins would be against Mycroft Hanna's murder. And B,
but it
a
turns
cousin...
out she actually... Yeah.
And yeah, and we, at the time, a cousin was felt comfortable just sort of saying, of course we weren't. Of course we were for Carlyle's death. And now it turns out the cousins were the most for Carlyle's death.
Mycroft's death.
Mycroft's death, sorry. Which makes us... I think it should at least let us reassess how we view the cousins.
I'm not sure it should. Perhaps we should see them as being less pure than they would like to be seen, but I think our view of the cousins is the prevailing one in the world.
But it isn't, right? Because they assume the cousins prevented Mycroft's death.
Exactly. Everyone assumes the cousins would have prevented Mycroft's death. So that doesn't tell me that I'm thinking of cousins incorrectly. People in the universe who know more about cousins than me also assume the cousins would have done that.
Yeah, but they were wrong. We know they're wrong.
Yeah.
Which means I'm thinking about cousins wrong.
I'm not sure that's true. Maybe they just have a real hypocritical leader.
And we also know Kal-El felt entirely comfortable just sort of saying, oh, of course, Kal-El. Of course, Kal-El didn't
look,
with it.
Your appeals to Carlyle's goodness as a person are going to not work on me.
That's not what I'm claiming.
We have already heard
I'm aware
Carlyle's that the
lying.
Cousins have the worst kind of legal system where they have strict codes for everything, but then ultimately do whatever they feel like. And you know what? Their leader having a strict moral stance about the sanctity of life, but then as soon as the, you know, it comes down to it, suddenly being pro-murder because of a loophole, which is I feel extra bad about this one. Totally congruous with my image of the cousins at this point, frankly.
Well, I still think you should think about them as strict moralists, lots of exceptions. I think you should think about them as people who want to take care of the world.
Okay.
And as Kosala says, if you want to take care of, like, a group of people and there's a rabid dog, you kill the dog. Irrelevant whether it was your friend beforehand.
Doesn't she say you shouldn't kill the dog?
No, she says she should.
Isn't that her example of what she would say to calm people down? Is that it's not the dog's fault? It is a poor, abused dog?
A poor, abused puppy. But then she ends off the exam by saying, well, if the dog's trying to kill people, you should kill the dog.
Sure. Look, either way, you can make that claim, but I'm just going to leave it hanging there that what happened here also fits really well with my primarily anti-Carlyle view of cousinry. Really well. Eerily well, some might say, that they would have the most loud and public anti-a-thing stance, and then the second it is convenient, have a helpful excuse and reason why this is an exception.
Okay.
You've convinced me, in fact. You know what? You're right. People are thinking of the cousins wrong. We should respect them less. I hadn't thought on this one long enough. You've brought me around.
That was not my intention, even a little bit. But I'm glad to see my words had some effect.
Also, to be fair, Mason clearly would like to kill Carlyle. Now you got me saying kill Carlyle. Would also like to kill Mycroft.
Mm-hmm.
He just knows it's a bad idea because Apollo said so.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and we find out about how Anonymous works. It turns out the first person to unmask the Anonymous gets to become the next Anonymous.
Yeah.
That's not a very good system for deciding who should be next. But sure, it's the one they have.
Well, I think the idea is that the Anonymous is supposed to be distinguished only by their reason, their excellence of their mind. And
yeah,
it's a good test.
Is it? Is
it's
it?
It's a test to preserve reasoning.
I don't think it preserves the right kinds of skills. That will make the Anonymous very good at determining who people secretly are, mm-hmm. but maybe not great at complicated geopolitics, which are not based on determining the secret identity of a public figure. I just think those are different tasks.
They are different tasks. I think the idea of the Anonymous is that, we're told that the Anonymous also invented the word for provocateur. So I think the Anonymous's job is not just complicated geopolitics, but just sort of in general being the most reasonable person in the room.
Hmm. In any case, I'm going to give it some thought. I don't want to think about it too much. When we get to the point at some point before the end of this book, because you've rolled in your die to tell me when I should read back through stuff and make my guesses,
mm-hmm.
remind me to take a shot at who the Anonymous is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm concerned that the Anonymous is going to not be a named character,
mm-hmm.
And so all of that effort will have been wasted, but I'm hopeful that it's a solvable puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
I think I didn't give it enough time the first chapter we were introduced to them because I was so convinced that the Anonymous was also the censor.
Mm-hmm.
I
will do that. I will tell you.
Yeah. It would be totally congruous for the Anonymous to be, you know, John Smith, who we've never spoken of before, except under their pseudonym, in which case, I don't think I'm going to be able to guess it, audience. But it's been noted as an interesting question so many times, I'm starting to think that it's one a careful reader could deduct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then I think the next thing to talk about is the Martys and what they thought. And what Mycroft
actually
thought.
I think the next thing is that I was wrong yet again. When I took my swing at how Dominic was, I was being faked out by the last chapter,
mm-hmm.
and Dominic had fought an actual
literal
four-legged animal. Unbelievably, this is when the book decided to stop being so literal about everything. It was Saladin.
Mm-hmm.
Who does register as a dog on the systems and records, but I don't get to claim credit for it.
Especially with how insistent you were that it was an actual dog.
Yeah, I that was the prediction.
No, it was a rat. You thought you caught a rat. No,
because he was a trap for a rat. And I thought it was a literal trap for an actual rat. And he said, and I caught a vicious dog, and I said, obviously the book wants me to think that's Saladin.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a trick. This book doesn't do metaphors. It's an actual four-legged mammal.
Mm-hmm.
No, disappointing. It turns out Dominic can take Saladin in a fight as long as he has backup. That's pretty impressive. I had the sense Saladin was pretty good at fighting.
Saladin, in the chapter where he says he's going to have to go out to Dominic, is told you have to just take him out quickly. And is like, well, I'm a torturer, I can only torture people. The same thing with, like, when Mycroft tells Saladin you have to just take up Bridger quickly. And you respond, no, I'm a torturer, I have to torture people. So I think Saladin is just, like, not that great at fighting, or, like, deliberately doesn't fight in order to try to torture people.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's possible that Saladin is actually not good in hand-to-hand combat and just is really intimidating at people instead, which I believe that it would work, but... It
doesn't work against Dominic.
Yeah, Dominic, noted stab artist, gets the better of this once his mother figure comes out and helps.
God damn. That does make the last chapter very deciding, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's all over these books. We need to read some more of these philosophers.
Yes. I actually have a list. I'm saying that a lot.
Sure, so don't give me the reading list, because I could probably put something together off of that. I'm just assuming there is one. Like, there must be.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what that is, and we'll go from there. So yeah, the next thing we get is that Dominic has trapped Saladin in a cage. Mycroft is there with him. And then we get into the Marty stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, also, fun character note. It turns out Apollo's Iliad is terrible.
Yeah.
And I like that. It's been so built up as the most important thing in the world. That's a fun little character beat, that Apollo was great at everything and just a bad author.
We also get
I hope to God it's not because it has a bunch of encoded information.
We're told that Apollo was a...
Okay, Apollo isn't a bad author. That would be weird. Apollo's Iliad is bad because there's a bunch of secret encoded information, and that's why the prose isn't very good.
What? Is that your...
Yeah.
What? That's your theory?
That's my guess.
Okay.
Throwing that one out there, yeah.
I was going to say that Apollo is a provocateur, and we get several hints as to what Apollo did. It's what the Martis did.
Yeah. They were war historians who were really into wars.
Well, Apollo wasn't necessarily a war historian. Apollo had a coat full of weapons. And necessarily...
I think that's totally coherent with Apollo also being a war historian.
Well, moreover, as Mason
points out... He just was doing something about it.
He had a thing full of weapons that wasn't the result of him alone. There was an entire industry of people making weapons and putting them in coats.
Which would be the Utopians, one has to assume. The ones with the coats.
I was trying to say. Note that this is not the first time Apollo's job has come up. It came up in book one. The first meeting of Madame's we saw, Mason asked Mycroft, what was Apollo's constellation doing? And Mycroft panicked and then responded, cultural preparations for Mars.
He asked, what was Apollo's what doing?
Constellation.
Oh, constellation. Okay.
Yeah.
I guess he was sort of right.
Hmm. Okay, so Mahdi's were war historians.
Mm-hmm. Thought there was going to be another war.
Mm-hmm.
Thought it was going to be a real bad war.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, well, we need to make sure it happens now while it's still containable and not before it would destroy the entire planet.
Mm-hmm.
So the Utopians and their mad rush to get to Mars sort of fits in. I'm not sure, that's a thing that works. The Utopians are getting ready to not lose the war. Mycroft thought that maybe they could do something different instead. I don't know. I'm coming down off of my rage on how I was disappointed and misled by the book. And it's... Now I'm just sort of depressed about it, so I don't know what else I'd like to talk about from this chapter.
Okay.
They had to go for the Martis planning to destroy the world. Ugh.
They weren't trying to save the world. They were literally planning to save it.
Well, it would have been pretty bad. They may have been overreacting. I'm not convinced they would have successfully saved the world.
Well, we learn that Mycroft thinks the thing that's preventing the Martis prediction from coming true is Madame's.
Yeah, and I think he might be right about that. But we also get that Mycroft thinks they could do something else other than another war. I hate to be agreeing with Mycroft so soon after he has disappointed me like this, but I think he's probably right, and that the Martis secretly plotting to do a war, probably bad.
Where does he say that?
The back end of the chapter.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I have... Again, I read this... in the hour before we started recording. I don't think I have exact lines for you.
Yeah, so Mycroft's solution was to turn back into beasts and kill each other one-on-one instead of en masse.
Yeah, and then you'll still have people learn sort of the horrors of violence.
Because Mycroft... So all the people... So we get that Kohaku's numbers predict war. And they're very...
We need to establish something for... Because there's like three people who don't read the book. The Marty's theory basically goes like this. Mm-hmm. War is inevitable. The severity of a war is proportional to the time it has been since the last war, the advancement in technology since the last war, and some third thing that I'm forgetting. What was the third thing?
Oh, gosh.
The third thing is less important to the setup of the story here, but is relevant.
I'm on that side. Three things makes wars more or less terrible. The length of peace before them, the amount of technological change, and how little mm-hmm. commanders know about the war's up-to-date realities.
There we go. Okay. And then they go on to say, you know, there's examples. World War One was super bad because there is so much relative peacetime in Europe before it happened. Mm-hmm. And then no one was ready for a full-scale fight with the modern technology when World War One started. Mm-hmm. And then I guess World War II, you just look at as sort of an extension of World War One, which I'm pretty on board for in general, and I don't want to get into the arguments about on this podcast.
Oh.
Look, it's been a long week. We can do that another... Maybe we'll make that a bonus episode. Is World War II just more of World War One? And then he says, look at today. It's been 222 years of peace. Technology has done ludicrous advancements, and no one understands what it's like to be on the ground in a fight in the modern day. The war to come will be utterly devastating, and only worsening by the day. So the Martys said, we need to make it happen now, when it may be survivable.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the last war would have been the Church Wars, so that it doesn't come in 100 years... when it won't be.
Mm-hmm.
And then they set out to start warmongering. By the way, that thing we argued about at the start of this book, I now agree with you. Tully is plausibly describable as a warmonger. They are doing things intentionally to cause a war. You were right. I just didn't know enough at the time.
I was not me.
Oh, who was I arguing with?
Mutter.
Oh, all right. Well then, in absentia, you know. Mm-hmm. Oops. And now that... the two people who don't read along have been caught up. Sort of. Mycroft's plan was we can work on three, I guess. Then, right? We can't change the time since the war. Mm-hmm. We can't change the advancement of technology. But if I do my thing and people start fighting and killing each other again, then people will at least understand the horrors of violence. The commanders will understand what it means to be in a fight in the modern day with modern technology.
I don't think
and
that's
that
true.
Will lessen the severity.
I don't think that's like Mycroft's theory. I think Mycroft's theory is that the reason why war... Mycroft thinks that violence is inherent to the human beings, and this is expressed in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
And one way this is expressed is through direct one-on-one killings. And so if we make sure that everyone is expressing their violence through killing each other or killing particular people, then we can prevent war, which is something worse.
I think that's a worse version of the argument.
I think that's the one that Mycroft literally says.
That implies that let me hear it again. Sorry, tell me that again, because that I don't think that makes... I don't think that really plays.
So Mycroft thinks that violence is inherent to the human person.
Yeah.
And it's going to be expressed in various ways. So mm-hmm. one way we can make sure that violence is not expressed via war is to give it an outlet via killing each other one-on-one.
Yeah, there we go. That's the part that I think is full-blown ridiculous. That's transparently untrue. That's
literally...
That allowing people to kill each other...
This is a quote from the chapter, from Mycroft.
Where? Show me the...
Page
95.
My solution was for us all to turn back into beasts and kill each other one-on-one instead of en masse.
Yeah. My read of that was not that Mycroft thinks he can undo all of societal progress. It was that maybe I'm giving Mycroft too much credit now. My read was not that he thinks he can undo human progress. It was that if people fight, they will understand what violence sort of means.
Well, I think Mycroft wants to just
because of this, like, to say that that means Mycroft thinks he can stop wars from happening just because people killed each other and did wars constantly throughout history. Mycroft, of all people, knows this.
I don't think Mycroft's plan is a good plan.
We agree on that.
I don't think Mycroft's plan is a good plan, and I think Mycroft knows it's not a good plan. And you shouldn't expect Mycroft's plan to be a good plan, because this is not a plan Mycroft sat down and thought through. This is the hidden thing he couldn't admit to himself that upon revelation broke him.
I think that Mycroft is presented in this chapter as being very intelligent, and that I should assume that the things he thinks aren't the stupidest possible reading of his sentences. And the dumbest possible read of this is that he thought if people got into fistfights often enough, they wouldn't want to have wars.
Not fistfights, like murders.
Yeah, sure. You can murder someone with punches.
He says, just before that line, I did it to keep violence in the hand of individuals. Mycroft thinks he can prevent wars by causing enough violence. Mycroft thought he could prevent wars.
I think Mycroft thinks that he can minimize that he can minimize the harm of wars, that he can make wars survivable by keeping violence in the hands of individuals.
I also wanted to prevent the war. Is a line he says after that.
Yeah, that would be good. Do you think he thought he could prevent all wars? No, the instantiated war by the Mardis that they were causing intentionally. You didn't want to prevent that war and not think you've stopped all war forever by letting people kill each other. I agree. I would like to stop the next war that is going to happen. I don't think that says anything about whether or not I believe that will stop all wars forever.
I don't think Mycroft thought that his murders and the way what he's going to do was going to stop all wars forever. I think he thought he was going to at least delay the next war.
Yes, I also think that.
In a way beyond just killing the Mardis would.
Yes, I also. Yes, I think that as well.
Yeah, and because you've seen Mycroft's theory of how violence, of how humans and war work. He thinks that there's some amount of violence in us, and we can express it in various ways. And if we just express it, that's okay. In certain ways, it's better than other ways. But there's always going to be that violence. Whereas Kohaku has these numbers, right?
Or the numbers that will lead to war, yeah.
Yeah, which are entirely economics-based.
As wars often are?
Yeah. And so I think Kohaku's and Mycroft's theories of war are different.
I don't think Mycroft thinks Kohaku is wrong.
I don't think Mycroft thinks Kohaku is wrong.
Mycroft
either.
Was brought up as one of the Mardis, right? He's very familiar with all of the things that they knew.
Yeah. I'm not saying that they are like loggerheads. I think if you asked Mycroft, Mycroft would say Kohaku's numbers make it more likely people will express. Okay, I don't know. I don't know if we know Kohaku's theory of war. We all we have is the numbers. I think I was attributing a more economics view of war to him. But I can have another theory of war and revolution. I can simply say, I can point out the fact that the single most predictive thing we have for political change on a revolutionary scale is the price of the local staple grain.
I'm not trying to argue with you that wars aren't, like, economically driven. The argument that I am picking with you is that I think Mycroft is gesturing at a better point than the one you are saddling him with. And I don't think there's enough here to justify, even with the lines you've pointed out, to justify assuming that he's doing, that he has sort of a bad understanding of what's going on.
I don't think
I think you need to do.
I don't think I don't think you do need to say that. Like has a bad understanding, because this isn't like Mycroft's philosophy, which he started trying. We heard snippets of when he was in the room before trying to get himself killed. This is the thing that he only realizes he thought now. We're looking back, that the first time he realized he thought it, literally.
I suppose there's a degree to which I just don't think that part is true, right?
What?
I think he didn't.
That's your theory.
I think he was
your
well aware of all of these. at things that were at play and just didn't think it was the thing driving his actions, or didn't put together the fact that that meant he was not choosing evil for evil's sake.
Okay.
Like, to the, but the, to then say, sorry, go on.
So you think Mycroft intellectually thought all of this stuff and thought it out, and then only made the connection that this is actually what he wanted when Jed pointed it out to him?
Yeah, that is not exactly where I am, but that's close enough that we're well within the same ballpark there.
Okay.
I think Mycroft definitely intellectually thought all of this out. I don't think Mycroft had made the connection that it was that it invalidated his other goals to have this secondary motive.
Okay. Okay, so Mycroft has this theory about how he should prevent the war. And it's not happening.
Yes.
Well,
he also thinks the war isn't happening. But basically, with the argument I tried to make at the end of the last book.
Well, this is what I want to get at, right? Because Mycroft thinks the war isn't happening because of Madame. Because of Madame's bash. We know that there's also been these series of assassinations that has also kept the peace, which Martin thinks also prevented war.
Mm-hmm.
And were it not for these assassinations, and were it not for Madame's, there would have been a war.
Yeah, I think the Martys were right.
Yeah.
Well, they were as right as they should have been given the information they had.
Yeah.
I don't think the Emperor, when he put the bash together, told them about OS or about Madame's.
Mm-hmm.
But, for example, this way that you're sort of framing the assassinations as a separate thing from Madame and her organization, I think that's not necessarily a good idea. I think there is a very meaningful sense in which OS is a tool of Madame's philosophy brothel. It's run by the people who are in it, and also now Casimir Perry, who's ruining everything. So,
well, I think
giving Madame the credit here is still appropriate.
Well, no, I don't disagree. No, I do disagree. We know
OS is not a separate...
calls himself the 13th OS.
Yeah.
Because
Occam dies, sure.
So, we know there's been a lot of OSs, and OS probably has something to do with the assassination things. And we know that Madame's only been around for like 50 years.
Yeah, that's, let's say 50 years. So we've got 13 OSs, 50 years. Thisbe was almost certainly one of them. So, yeah, I'm pretty on board.
Clearly
they kind
OS,
of want to claim...
You think there's a new OS like at least once every like 3 years or something?
I think it's plausible. Well, we can drop one on a historical figure, right? I think OS as it is currently incarnated is probably a relatively recent development. Whether or not they claim sort of additional historic ties, so the parents' generation perhaps had an OS, but that 50 years ago, that's totally within reasonable bounds, right? So perhaps there have been a series throughout history of people who claimed this title, but yeah, I think even if OS was prior an independent organization, conceiving of OS as a separate factor in the world than Madame and her influence is as silly as thinking of the Emperor as a separate factor in the world than Madame and her influence.
No, you should. What?
Yeah.
No, Madame...
I don't know why you would do that.
Madame's...
They act on orders.
What? We've seen the inside of Madame the brothel. That's not how Madame runs things. Madame...
What are you talking about?
When I'm talking about Madame's influence, I don't mean some sort of, like, top-down hierarchy. Because that's not what happens in the upper chamber. And I don't mean some sort of ambiguous web of connections. I specifically am talking about... the sort of pseudo-bash that is created at the very top.
That is also what I'm talking about. OS is commanded by a member of that bash.
Yes.
So they're not a separate entity. They are literally taking orders from that bash.
No, what? We've seen how the bash functions. That's not how the bash functions. It doesn't, like, take orders.
What are you... But OS does.
OS does.
From
like,
who?
The Bash is not...
Sorry, OS takes orders from who?
A member of the Bash.
Which one?
Ganymede, officially. So in the chapter, Ando, Casimir Perry, who's now a member of the, going to be a member of like the top, up the upper room.
Okay, yeah. So hear me out.
Ganymede.
Why are you positive? Like, where are you drawing this distinction between the Bash and the thing that takes orders directly from one of its members?
Because Ganymede isn't the Bash.
Sure. But in that same sense, none of them are. Are you then going to say, like, oh, but in a way, none are the whole? Like, yeah, that's technically true, but it's uninteresting.
It's absolutely true. Few people disagree with their families or disagree with, like, the opposition they're part of all the time. And this is, like, relevant, especially for world politics, because they all have independent bases of power.
Mm-hmm. Why are we giving credit to two separate... I just think your framing of this is weird, and maybe it's based on something I don't know yet, but to say there have been two separate forces keeping the world from falling to war, the influence of Madame and her Bash, and also the personal errand boy of one member of Madame's Bash. Why would you make those into two unique entities? What's driving that choice?
I think because it's very clear in that chapter that OS has personal fealty to the humanist hive, and by extension, Ganymede.
Sure, but that's true of all of the Bashes relative to their independent leader. The Mitsubishis may similarly be doing all kinds of things that stop war from happening.
Yeah.
And so might the... I'm running out of other organizations that I remember the names of. The Brillists might be running their own second ring of assassins that are stopping wars from breaking out. But to then say, there are seven independent forces, eight independent forces stopping war from happening. There's Madame and how she has organized and coalesced the major forces into one sort of single entity and can control them all through subtle influence, and then independently each of those major forces also as a separate thing we're thinking of distinctly in this metaphor. And also we have to keep in mind the individual sub-organizations that exist within them. So, like, there is, of course, the Brillist's accountant, who is stopping war from breaking out by allowing Felix to think about other things. This is just a weird angle to take.
Okay, so... one reason why I think is you should think about this as a different reason is because a lot of the actions that OS takes, they are for the benefits of the humanists, Europeans, and Mitsubishi, and to the detriment of the other hives.
Okay.
And I think since these people, all the organization, which does them benefit to the detriment of everyone else, it can be conceivably thought of as not simply being an extension of the Bash. Because it's not something they
clearly everyone knows about OS.
You think everyone knows about the OS?
Yes. I don't even think that's... that doesn't even seem controversial to me.
The king doesn't know about OS. Spain does not know about OS.
That's ludicrous. You're telling me they let Casimir... fucking Perry in on this secret before they let in Spain?
Because Spain is, everyone knows, everyone thinks that Spain is Catholic, and Catholics notably are against murder now.
Okay.
And so...
hear me out. You know what else Catholics are against? Most of the things that happen at Madame's. Like, there's an ongoing affair 100% of the time that Bash is meeting. So, I don't think that really holds water as an argument.
We actually do know. Like, this is talked about in chapter 3. Specifically, they talk about how the king doesn't know.
They specifically say the king doesn't know.
Yeah.
Do they say the king doesn't know as in, like, for some reason... somehow they've kept this a secret from the rest of the entire Bash, or just that specifically they didn't tell the king because of the Catholicism?
Specifically, they couldn't tell the king because they think the king would go against them. And this is why, apparently, there's been some secret subcommittee of the European Parliament, which has been in charge of, like, Europe's part of this. We'll find the lines.
Okay. I will believe you about it. But my general purpose proposition here is still that basically everyone at Madame's knows about the whole OS situation.
Okay.
Even if we have been told the king specifically doesn't.
Do you think Jed knows?
I don't really think of Jed as part of Madame's bash, honestly.
But that's fair. There's a distinction in the books made between bastards and their children.
Yeah. I think he probably doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Because what? Because he has that whole thing about dying. He probably sorted that out in his imaginary slash maybe more actually real than I had sort of been giving credit universe. I wonder if we'll get more on that. There can't be that many references to the king in the first
can't be
two
what?
Chapters. There can't be that many references to Spain in the first two chapters.
I should just search for it.
Yeah, you've read this book before. I have not. I assure you, if I had read this book before, I would have been making better guesses this entire time. Although, frankly, it turns out I did pretty okay in my reading of book one. I've been given confirmation on a number of things early on in this book. I'm quite pleased. Even if a couple of them were disappointing revelations.
It was no end of difficulty trying to run Europe's Indo-OS alone, while Spain was prime minister, trying to guess what the hive needed when most of our leadership didn't know. I was important enough to bother informing of pending trouble. So apparently, Pasman Perry wasn't even that important, but he was just in charge of like a committee which ran OS, which I think is very funny.
You're kind of right. I'm optimistic I will come to like Casimir Perry a little bit better as I find out more about him as a character. Because, you know, based purely on this introduction, he's really the Carlyle of book two.
Okay, so apparently, we know Spain doesn't know. Maybe other people know. You think probably other people know.
I mean, surely the Anonymous knows. Anonymous is supposed to be clever.
Okay.
Probably.
Okay.
Boy, you know, we are actually, now that I'm looking at the paper edition of this book, we are getting through this a lot faster than I thought we would.
Yeah.
I feel like we just started Seven Surrenders, and we're already a quarter of the way through it.
Do you have Talk the Lightning in paperback too?
Huh?
Do you have Talk the Lightning in paperback too? Like with you?
Yes. In fact,
compare the two.
A factory reject copy of Too Like the Lightning. The binding wasn't done correctly.
Okay. That sounds suspicious, but okay. But, like, compare the thicknesses.
All right, I have them in my hands. Book two is somewhat shorter.
Mm-hmm.
But not overwhelmingly short. Well, let's see. 441 pages. How many pages is book two, so I don't have to open to the last page?
One second. 364.
Okay, so they're not... It's not a huge difference.
I'm not sure how they got the page numbers. I have a Kindle.
I do understand why they made Too Like the Lightning longer to fit in at least something at the end of it. If you split these actually down the middle, I think you would end up leaving off Too Like the Lightning at like...
The introduction of Madame's or something?
Something bad, yeah. The chapter where Saladin gets Bridger would be the first one you don't get. So the last thing that would have happened is the Emperor would have told Mycroft, never speak Apollo's words again. End of the book. Come find book two.
That's actually pretty, it's pretty, like, I don't know, as ending was, they're pretty cool, but it's also like it would be a bad time to end the book. You don't know anything.
Yeah, we had... Why? I wouldn't have read book two. I would have felt like they just forgot to finish writing this book and printed it anyway, if that's where it stopped.
The thing is so popular.
Have you found that's...
Found what?
Have you found that line you've been searching for?
I did, I just read it.
Oh, good. Oh, that's right. Wait,
yeah.
What have I been waiting on?
I don't know.
Waiting for you to do something.
I don't know. I got it.
Oops. What else happens? So where we kind of end off is, sounds like the Utopians are planning to do a war. Saw that one coming too. Thank you very much. I knew to be suspicious of them. I'm actually getting worried with all these correct predictions that I've just been cheating and suspecting everyone.
Well, you have to keep track of the false ones too. I'll have to do a re-listen and like note all of your predictions so he can give you like a score.
Okay, go ahead and do that. Mm-hmm. I think I've at least been pretty consistent that I think the Utopians are clearly in the middle of some conspiracy.
You think? And you thought they're the middle of a meta conspiracy is the thing you said.
Yeah. Well, they're gonna do a lot of murders.
Mycroft specifically thinks that war is different from just a lot of murders.
I think Mycroft's kind of wrong about that.
I think Mycroft's pretty right about that.
Why?
What?
That's just true. You're still murdering a ton of people when you do
a
war.
Sure, but like...
Like, if you're redefining this just so that you can feel better about your wars, maybe don't have wars as often.
No, wars are worse than murders.
Oh, well, I'm not sure that's true. Wars are... in a trivial sense, that's true. Like, when you do a war, you do a lot more than just kill a bunch of people.
If you have a choice between a war that kills N people and a killing N people individually, you should take killing N people individually.
Well, but is that just because you don't want the associated damages? What if I also do your infrastructural damage? Just to even it up.
No, I didn't hear any of the middle part, but like I think part is only because of the associated damages. There's lots of other things that happen in wars, which are very, very bad.
Fine. We've agreed as a podcast that wars are bad.
Yes. Okay. What is it? We disendorse war.
We said slavery was bad.
Torture, slavery,
yeah.
And rape. And that's it. That's all the things we think are bad.
Yep.
And tyranny. I think tyranny is bad. You don't think tyranny is bad. So it's
I mean, talk to me about the details of this tyranny. You know what? I don't think I can claim much credit for this. I think the things that I was accusing the Utopians of were instituting a plan to take over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of through the downfall of the current one, but ultimately like a take over the world plan. And I guess this really is more just a escape to Mars in a potential war plan, which is kind of different.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? Or are we kind of through the chapter for the week? At the very end, we find about the Utopians. We find out about the Martys. Mycroft is left in a cage with Saladin, and he admits that he might have been wrong about a bunch of stuff because he found out about Jehovah, and he was introduced to the concept of doubt. If any listeners are wondering, by the way, I 100% think that what happened to Mycroft from Jed, he attacked his brain. I'm taking this one. Yeah,
they think the words a single sentence is enough to qualify as a brain whammy.
I think it happened.
Okay.
Yep.
So at the very end, you said
he's left in a cage, and he admits to Saladin that he hasn't really believed in their cause in a while.
Well, I think it's pretty interesting because according to the schema that we've gotten from Mycroft about the wars, apparently if his goal was to like prevent war, he didn't have to do anything.
Yeah.
Like the Martys would have tried to stop one, but like they would have been prevented, so he didn't have to kill them.
Yeah,
so it's just
as he
didn't have to
it,
prevent a war by killing them like the way he did. So he just like did something for nothing.
Yeah, which ironically is what he was trying to do. The fact that he's sad about it is yet more proof that maybe people think Mycroft is smarter than he is.
What do you think of Saladin? Saladin apparently is free.
And at the very end, apparently Bridger looks a lot like Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they want me to think about that. Maybe Apollo made the Jesus baby? Whatever. One last thing, though. Did I mention how obvious it seems that Bridger is named Bridger because he's going to act as like a bridge between all the different hives? Have I gotten into that yet?
No.
That sentence was basically all my thoughts on it.
Okay.
It's like a shepherd-style name, where mm-hmm. it's pretty straightforward what maybe mm-hmm. someone named that could do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or perhaps a bridge between worlds, that kind of thing. Do you have any other notes?
Oh, we should talk about Saladin. So Saladin is confirmed in this chapter, was a former Bash, mate of Mycroft.
Wasn't that confirmed last book? Wasn't that confirmed last? Oh no, you told me that last book.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I think you could get what it was true that it was true last book, but I was reading a little bit into it.
Fair enough. Okay. Yeah. We found out where he came from. He's been hiding as a dog.
And it turns out that Saladin at some point lost all of his skin, and Mycroft replaced it with his skin.
Yes.
Which means that when they tested Saladin's DNA, they just found Mycroft's DNA.
Now, what do you think the odds are that there's been a switcheroo here, and they've lost track of which one of them was the original with the skin?
I don't know.
I think that would be dumb enough.
Saladin lost all of his hair. They didn't replace his hair when they replaced his skin.
That's true. He only has the skin. So it must be that Mycroft, our Mycroft, was the original Mycroft with the Mycroft skin.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be the fact that our Mycroft was the one who was abandoned and got the skin grafts. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
It would have been a very dumb plot twist, but it also would have been very murder mystery. And, if I'm being honest, the humanist boots, also very murder mystery. I'm kind of hoping we're going to get a genre book before this series is over.
So boy, you've already got a mystery. You already had a detective finding a murderers. Hot on the Trail of Murderers, right? You have
yeah, I know. Martin,
Hot on the Trail of
Murderers.
These
are some of my favorite books. I'm very into it. If it was just a little more, it would only get better. Anything else we want to touch on? I know I've asked that four times, but I have run out of interesting thoughts about the book.
We have to do this now. I admit defeat.
Okay.
You won the ethics bowl.
Oh, that was crucial context.
Yeah, you won the ethics bowl.
Yeah, it was unanimous, was it not?
I think so. Let me check. And let me relay some things.
Yes, we should I know there were a couple of comments. We should address them while we have access to it on the air. So, to those of you who filled out the form and sent in your responses, good job. I told you it would be more fun if you did it that way. To those of you who didn't do the form, if you're listening to this, you've already listened to that episode, so I can't suggest you do the form anyway, even if you don't send it in. But when you're listening to the next Ethics Bowl episode, at the end of this book, I really suggest you do fill out the judge's sheet while you go. It will be better that way. I'm looking at the responses now.
Yeah, but I want to give official scores.
It looks like it is.
Yeah.
I know it was unanimous at 4, and I'm looking at 5.
5 scored us particularly low and you particularly high, because, and I quote, I voted team only sometimes more favorably because they asked.
Good job. So yeah, it remained unanimous that mm-hmm. team only sometimes was in fact the king of Ethics Bowl Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Morally superior, intellectually superior. Just kind of better people, if you will. To those of you who are on the team and listening, which by my count is about 3% of our entire audience, congratulations! We won!
That is true.
Oh, actually, you know what? That's a lie. Nope, I'm close to right. One of the people on my team was not part of our audience.
One of the people on your team, as you will know if you listen to the Ethics Bowl episode, didn't read the book and was the person in charge of the case for it. You guys were so lucky.
Yes, we were. it could have gone very badly. But we won the coin toss, is what happened there.
I bet. It's been so good.
So let me pull up the responses, because we had one or two. One of you said in commentary, I've never experienced an ethics bowl before, so I wasn't sure how much research and information the contestants had beforehand or what they were allowed to reference. For example, I thought the true crime podcast discussion rather obviously left out the history of true crime as entertainment and how this isn't a new social media-born phenomenon, and I wasn't sure if it was because it was a requirement or because that is a hole in the contestants' knowledge. Well, in theory, we would have been allowed to reference anything and should have known all of that. In practice, our team read that case approximately 20 minutes before we started recording.
Oh my god.
So
I was going to talk about
that's
how
why
I was shitty, because I didn't only read it and did a little bit of research. But man, we were so much better prepared than you. How did you guys win?
Our entire research for that case was during those 20 minutes. I googled how many people had downloaded Serial.
You did bring that up a lot. I was wondering why.
That's because it was the only fact we had.
Oh my god.
But it was a good fact, right? And that's often what counts.
It was a good fact. The first three times they didn't think it was that weird. You brought it up.
Yeah, exactly.
You did keep bringing it up.
So that was all a massive hole in our knowledge. None of us had any idea what we were talking about.
Yeah.
We really should have and intended to get together and plan out a case in advance. But luckily, our opponents sort of fell on their own swords a little bit and just didn't do an ethics theory for
we
their
We did. We just case. Had three different ones.
Yeah, all at the same time. And you didn't explain how they work.
I did. We all explained one at a time. Well, in the mode of argument, trying to refute the other people on our team.
Yeah, so that's how we won, despite having been less prepared than you. Also, we sounded more prepared.
That's true. You guys did. There's a point in there where like, we are like, oh, well, fuck, they prepared so much. I just said out loud, you guys prepared so much better than us. That's just not true.
Yeah. It wasn't even the smallest bit true, no. The 10-15 minutes before we started recording was the first time my team had ever spoken to each other.
including over text. At one point, Johnny went in there, and they came back just to let you guys know to come in, and he said, apparently, you guys, everyone was trying to do utilitarianism. And you said, you have to do one theory that's not Utila, and then Johnny left.
I didn't want to do utilitarianism because I thought it would be kind of easy and boring.
Why?
I stand
why
by that.
Why do you not want to do easy ethical theories in a competition?
Because I got to force people to do an ethics bowl with me, and I wasn't going to waste my opportunity on a boring, easy case. I wanted to take something fun and exciting. So we went with social contract, a theory I have a lot of problems with, but is really good if you go first, because you can just declare mm-hmm. the social contract to basically be whatever is convenientest for you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the secret to it.
As you did.
As I did. Yeah, I demonstrated, and it worked. We won unanimously. Maybe you should try social contract next time. Maybe. I'm going to try research.
I'm going to try DeSad. I think that's ethical theory, I haven't really. I think if you say it out loud, it's just so fucking yeah. ridiculous that, like, you people can't argue with it. You just sort of publicize that you believe that at all, even a little bit. Well, it's as good as you don't, but you're just sort of saying it out loud.
That is fun. Yeah, okay. If you change your mind about that, let me know and I will, because I would like to get that going in the next Ethics Bowl episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that, I have now responded to all the commentary that we actually received.
Two pieces of commentary.
Yeah, well, we got five responses. It's more than I expected. Because,
yeah.
Here's the thing.
I think I expected six.
This is a small podcast.
Six. Almost
you did.
Right.
You were closer. Price is Right rules, though, I would have won.
Hmm.
I did some figuring recently. And I think something like 25 to 30% of our audience has been a guest on this show.
Oh, yeah.
Which I feel like is high, even for small-time podcasting.
Welcome to fandom.
I mean, we're well on the way to having had half of the audience on the show.
That should be our
goal. If you listen to this show, yeah, if you haven't been on yet, call us. We'll give you an episode. We do not have standards. If you have any interest at all about talking about these books, we'll have you on for a week. I would love to be able to say that I host a podcast and I've had half of the listeners on the show. Mm-hmm. That's a very fun line.
I
think we can make it happen. We have, like, you know, 45 listeners, I think, total.
60.
Are we up to 60? That's pretty good.
I mean, I've been looking
at the
numbers.
Ada Palmer, I guess, responded to a tweet about the podcast last week. How did that go?
I think, wow.
Did anything come of it?
Actual tweets.
Okay, well. Wait, you did ask. You did give out the invite, right?
I did.
Okay,
I just forgot, you know, because we're not. It happened once on thing. She just said to do something for book 4, which is very interesting. And that's like the plan. So I know I can. I don't know why I'm stressed out about this. Okay, we'll do this. I'll do this. I'll get over myself and do it. Just not right now.
What are you stressed about?
Contacting the Ada Palmer.
What? Why? Do they have a reputation for suing people who call them?
I'm being silly. Nothing reasonable.
Oh, you are. There's not information I don't know that makes this a more reasonable fear.
No, I'm being silly.
Sending someone a letter.
Yeah, no, I'm being silly.
Okay. I could send an actual letter inviting them on the show.
Oh, God, yes. Yes.
Because I've been doing that for all of our listeners. I've got... Yeah, I'll do up a typewritten letter for Dr. Palmer, and I'll mail that to the University of Chicago?
Yeah, I